This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Venice, Italy. I am a cruise ship fanatic, but nobody beats me to that better than my next guest. He is a longtime cruise ship fanatic. In fact, longtime ship fanatic. I would like to call him our resident historian as well. Our good pal, Peter Canego. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Peter. Great to talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I mean, how could I be doing badly? I'm on the Silver Spirit here in Venice. On a beautiful, beautiful day. And, you know, every time I sail into Venice, I like to romanticize that I've been sailing here in like five previous lives. It's and in fact, I think I have. And this ship was so big that we literally towered over St. Mark's Square. I mean, we towered over it. Silver Spirit's a much smaller ship. We don't really tower over much, which is kind of nice because we actually get to see the skyline. We're not the skyline. But you've seen all the evolution of all of these ships here in Venice, and they're actually trying to start to limit the tonnage that comes into Venice, aren't they?
Yeah, I think, you know, they're reporting damage now to a lot of the foundations around the monuments because of the water ingress from the ships coming in. So I hope they can solve that because obviously it's such a great port to sail into, and hopefully maybe they'll start building some smaller ships that that don't create that problem that people can use. And you're on one, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan. Listen, I understand the bigger ships. It's a different market. I understand what they can do that the smaller ships can't. And conversely, I can understand what the smaller ships can do that the bigger ships can't. And it's a very nice feeling, or a more intimate feeling, I should say, to be on a ship with only about 600 passengers as opposed to 6,000 passengers.
Yeah, and especially when it's a Silver Sea ship like you're on. But is Paolo the hotel manager with you guys on this sailing?
only you would ask questions on a first name basis about who's on this ship. You're out of your mind. I love it. You know what? I will check.
Go ahead. His dad was a Costa captain and goes way back to the early days of Costa Line. And when I found that out, of course, he became one of my favorite people, and he's got a lot of great stories. So you may want to track him down if he is.
I will. Speaking of great stories, you know, I note with some sorrow the passing earlier this summer of a John Maxtone Graham, who truly was one of the great historians when it comes to maritime history, not just cruise lines, but ships of all kinds. Wrote so many great books, including one about the Normandy. And what a great storyteller he was.
Yeah, he was, to me, the great ocean liner raconteur. If Cary Grant were an ocean liner historian and lecturer, I think, that's pretty much what John Maxtone Graham was like. He just had the greatest stories. He was an elegant man, always impeccably dressed, biting sense of humor. It was actually his book, The Only Way to Cross, which was published in 1972, that got me into ships. That and the Poseidon Adventure, which actually came out the same year. I was smitten with ocean liners. And his text, it's written like poetry. I mean, he was really, really an elegant man, the kind of people that you just don't see today. He was a superb storyteller. I remember on the Rotterdam's final voyage, he did a lecture about the Titanic, about Violet Jessop, the stewardess who served not only aboard the Titanic, but aboard the Britannic when it was sunk, the sister ship of the Titanic, and worked on the Olympic when it had a collision. So she had a fantastic story alone. But John, for some reason, there was a problem with the electricals in the auditorium, and they couldn't set up his presentation. So he just stood on stage, just this one man by himself for over an hour, and told the stories. And that was one of the most incredibly riveting performances I have ever seen. I mean, he truly was like a man of the stage.
Peter, stay with me for one second. When we come back, okay. More with you when we return to the Silver Spirit here in Venice, because the stories that John Maxtone Graham said, just the beginning of a much bigger story. Back with more right after this. Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. We've been speaking with historian Peter Canego about all ships at sea, some of them floating, some of them no longer with us, and speaking also about a wonderful historian named John Maxtone Graham, who, by the way, debunked the myth in one of his books that the Normandy was actually sabotaged by the Nazis when it basically burned and was lost forever at a pier in New York, the famous French ship Normandy. And this is what he wrote, which I thought was fascinating. He described what was left of that ship as upended, demeaned, and undignified, like a dowager who, slipping on a wintry sidewalk, falls with upraised skirt, helpless prey for voyeurs. You couldn't, I mean, and when you saw what was left of that ship after the fire, he got it.
Yeah, the Normandy was the most beautiful ship ever built. I think almost any ship enthusiast would agree to that. And what happened to her was so devastating, and the process of raising her took years, and by the time they got her up, she was just a gutted, rusted hulk. And it was really one of the saddest things that could have possibly happened. But in a way, it made the Normandy like the Marilyn Monroe of cruise ship, of ocean liners. She died at a beautiful age, at her prime, and everybody remembers what she was, instead of what she became later on, which, you know, nobody said she was tired and worn out like they did with the Queens in the 60s when they were sailing half full. So in a way, it preserved her legend, but it was a tragedy for all of us.
Well, speaking of hulls that were somewhat forgotten, whatever happened with the SS United States?
United States is still sitting in Philadelphia. There is a sort of a mum plan. They have an investor who's very, very interested in bringing her, it's believed, to the port of New York to be preserved as a museum, hotel, convention center type facility. But they can't release any details because it's still in negotiation and they don't want to destroy the negotiation process. So that's the latest rumor. It's been going on for a few months. But apparently these new investors are helping with the funding of keeping the ship at the pier, which has been their biggest problem. I believe it's a $30,000 a month bill just to keep the United States sitting idle. And then they have to keep people on her to make sure that, you know, valves are cleared and the decks aren't filled with water and various things like that when it rains. So it's been quite a process, and people are keeping their hopes high, but it has been a long, long time that ship has sat idle with nothing but plans and nowhere to go.
Well, you mentioned the investor. At one point, I think Norwegian Cruise Lines had an interest in that ship, correct?
Yes, they did. They were going to try to bring her back for their Hawaii cruise service, and they had been projecting a four-ship fleet, but as you know, the Hawaiian venture didn't go as well as they planned, and they scaled down from three ships at one time to just one now. And I think that they're even having trouble keeping that ship full because people are more interested in going overseas right now than Hawaii.
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but speaking of the SS United States, are there any other ships of its era or slightly after it that are just sitting idly by with nobody knowing what to do with them?
Well, sadly, one just went for scrap, this beautiful little Turkish liner called the Akdeniz, which was 100% intact, and nobody's heard of it, but it was an important ship because it was the very last of its kind. And then a few years later than that, in 1959, Holland America built the Rotterdam, which was a dual transatlantic liner and cruise ship. Fortunately, her story is wonderful. She's been beautifully preserved in the city of Rotterdam. It did take a €230 million investment to remove all the asbestos and to rebuild the ship as a floating hotel. But finally, when they did it, after two bankruptcies, this company that's running the ship is doing a superb job. I went to stay on board a couple nights earlier this year and was blown away. It was so nice to see this beautiful ship with all this incredible artwork and wood paneling and these elegant two-deck lounges, grand staircases. She's been beautifully restored, and it looks like the city of Rotterdam is loving her, which is not the usual case when they try to preserve a ship. It usually ends up being a financial disaster. And I think right now the Rotterdam's in really good hands, and she's a success. So that's one thing to rejoice. There's one ship that's sitting around actually fulfilling a purpose in its afterlife, in addition to the Queen Mary, of course.
You're right. Yeah. I was actually on the last voyage of the Rotterdam from Rotterdam to New York before it was sold and then finally brought back to Rotterdam as a floating hotel. And I was on it last year and was very impressed as well, simply because I didn't expect anybody to take an interest in it. And yet so many people had transited the ocean, had crossed the ocean on the Rotterdam. There was such an emotional connection with that ship that when I was on it last year, a lot of people were taking their kids and their grandkids around to show them where they'd stayed on the ship. I thought that was really quite touching.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
I remember years ago, I was on the last cruise, literally the last cruise of the Rotterdam, going from basically from Rotterdam to New York before Holland America sold the ship. And there was a woman on the ship, and I was told, you better watch out for her because she lives on the ship and she's single and her name is Kissing Annie. And if you go into the dining room after dinner, right, she's going to come after you and make you kiss her and dance with her. And they were right.
Okay.
But then I got a chance to talk to Annie, and you know what? She had the best life going. She literally figured out a way to live full-time on that ship, and she was very sad because she was literally losing the ship. Joining me now, Joseph and Susan Buckley from Annapolis, Maryland, who I just happened to bump into here on the ship. You've cruised how long on Silver Sea?
Since 1996.
Wow. And how many times a year?
We're on 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
Five,
so,
six.
And so the authorities haven't found you yet?
No.
They haven't.
Incognito.
No.
Wow. How did you decide to do that?
How did we decide to cruise so much?
And then, well, first of all, how did you decide to cruise? And then pick one line and just stay with it.
We started cruising in the mid-70s on other lines, because obviously Silver Sea did not exist.
So what lines were they?
Oh, we've been on Holland American, we've been on Cunard, we've been on Sea Dream, we've been on the one with the sails.
Windstar.
We've been on...
Crystal.
So basically, you've been thrown off every other cruise
line. That's right, the only one left.
I just want to make sure that the only place that would accept you would be...
The only place left where we can go.
Yeah, we just, as I said, we've tried every region, everybody, Seabourn, but...
This seems to fit us best.
This fits us best.
Why?
The crew.
It's all about the crew.
Everybody has pretty ships. It's the crew.
You know, I'm one of those people who believes in the word that starts with a C. It's called the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You engage people. You mm-hmm. talk to them. You learn about them. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, relationships develop, right? So I would guess, how many days have you been on Silver Sea or cruises?
Over 1,800.
1,800 days.
Yeah. Okay.
So I would suspect, and Joseph, you tell me if I'm wrong, that as you walk down the hallways of the ship and along the gangways and along the different decks, everybody says, hi, Joseph.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And if they don't, then they're the new guys on board.
Then they learn.
Then they learn.
Then we welcome them aboard.
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
You're part of the welcoming committee now.
That's correct.
So they haven't given you a uniform with stripes yet?
No, but I have a name tag.
You do?
Yes.
Oh, my. It's getting out of control then, isn't it?
Yeah, we've actually tended bar at some crew parties, so.
You see, now you know you've made it when they let you go to the crew deck.
It's true.
Shh.
No, it's the secret's out. It's over.
Yeah,
the
secret's out.
I know. Yeah, well, let's face it. That's where the fun parties are.
Yes.
Come on. You know I'm right. What's the biggest surprise for you now? Because I would think that you're such veterans on this ship. You take it for granted now?
It's home. It's our other home. People live in New York and Tokyo. We live in Annapolis and Silver Sea.
And the cool thing is you're never unpacking.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Well, every once in a while, once you're here, right?
Oh, sure, sure.
But we do sail on all five of the original ships, so the luggage occasionally has to move back and forth.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear
it's
that.
It's terrible. It's
just
terrible.
Disgusting.
Yes.
Someone should write a letter. Your friends back home, do you think something's abnormal here?
No, they usually start a conversation with, okay, let me get this straight. You live on the water, you have a boat, and you cruise. Okay, so the question is, I love the water. We love the water.
So back in Annapolis, where do you live?
On the bay,
Chesapeake Bay.
So you're on the water all the time?
Yeah.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
I was born and raised on the beach.
Very lucky people.
We're very lucky
saying,
people.
You know, if you can live on the water, you're lucky enough.
I totally agree with you because I live on the water, so
yes.
we're both very lucky.
Lucky enough.
Okay, devil's advocate question. What do you not like about the ship?
This ship or any of them? Any ship.
This ship.
Let's start with any ship.
Any ship. I don't know. I think sometimes the guests. This ship is
not our kind, dear.
This ship is a little too big for me. So
this one is.
Yeah.
Okay, but relative to other ships, it's very intimate.
That's correct.
Relative.
Yeah. All right. And what do you like about this ship?
The crew.
I think it's the crew, basically. Crew and the team that runs the ship. I mean. They're really nice to us, and we have fun with them.
Now, because you've been here so long, the word special request, does that ring a bell at all?
Yes, of course.
What are your special requests on this ship?
The food is lovely, but when you're here as long as we are, you get tired of it.
So what do?
We have roast chicken, mashed potatoes, and peas.
Something simple.
Every night?
No.
Okay.
No, but that's about all we
request.
Yeah,
that's about it.
So that's a special order for you.
That's a
special
order. But I will say this. Yeah. I mean, anything you want, they'll get you. If they've got it, they'll get it.
So here's my question. What's the craziest thing you ever asked where they got you?
Duct tape.
Was somebody misbehaving?
No. early on, when the ships first started, don't tell him, and the curtains and the drapes were cut very tightly.
Yeah.
There was not any extra material, and I can't sleep if it's light. So
you had to black out the room.
That's right.
So I duct taped the ends of the drapes.
So basically your room looked like you were taking hostages and you were a barricaded suspect.
Yes.
Where are the wagons?
The wagon is too slow. Can't you ride?
It's not that he can't ride. How is it you put it home?
They're dangerous at both ends and crafty in the middle. Why would I want anything with a mind of its own bobbing about between my legs?
Honored to have with us the captain of the Silver Spirit, Alessandro Zanello. Did I say it right?
You said it right, yeah.
Yeah, but you hear that accent? Wait a minute. But that accent, it doesn't sound like a Zanello.
Well, I am a Zanello, but I'm half Australian, so I've been told that I've got a very interesting accent for sure.
Okay, how did a half Australian guy get to Venice on the Silver Spirit?
Well, my father was a captain, and he met my mother on a ship that was called the Fiesta, ex-Sidmore.
The Fiesta, oh my God.
Faystar.
Oh, the Faystar.
Yeah, and then became P&O Holidays. Some 42 years later, here I am on the Silver Spirit.
Wow.
So, yeah. And that's the Australian part is from my mom. And my dad is obviously with that last name, is the Italian.
But you trained in Italy.
I trained in Italy. I went to school in Italy. I only spent my Christmas holidays in Australia, but I grew up in Italy. Yeah.
Now, you first came on board, what, the Silver Wind?
Silver Wind, 1999, was my first contract with Silver Sea, yes.
How has cruising changed for you in terms of where you're going and how you do your job?
Well, I started in 1993 with Princess, so it was a completely different company.
What ship was it?
Star Princess.
Wow.
The old Star Princess.
The old one, yeah. Yes.
And which was a completely different cruising experience, different size of ship, obviously.
Was it the same size as the Pacific Princess, wasn't it?
It was a little bit bigger. Yeah. It was about 60,000 tons.
Because people forget that the Pacific Princess, the original love boat,
yeah,
right, which they just broke up last year.
Yeah.
Finally, they broke it up.
Yeah.
Was a very small ship.
It was a tiny ship. Now, the Star Princess was not as small. It was a good size. It's still sailing in the Pacific.
As what?
Pacific Jewel or something like that down in Australia, New Zealand. And so I moved to Silver Sea in 1999 as the Silver Sea had an Italian flagship. And I didn't know what to expect. People asking me to come here, I fell in love with it. It's a completely different experience. You're really familiar with all the crew on board, you know, and destinations were very different than doing the same 7-day cruise over and over again for six months.
Well, this ship is a relatively new ship, and so the systems on this ship are new.
Yes.
I mean, just your steering mechanisms, your propulsion systems, your joysticks.
Yeah,
right?
We don't have a joystick, as a matter of fact, on this ship.
You don't?
We don't.
You know what? I'm so happy to hear that. You know, it's just sort of like somebody actually does it.
Yeah, we do it manually here. We've got bow thrusters, obviously, but we don't have a joystick
that does everything. Everybody
together.
Has bow thrusters.
Well, you need bow thrusters, but we don't have a joystick that combines all the systems.
And no pods.
No, as a pod, no.
You know what? I'm so happy to hear that, too, because you get pods, they break.
They do break, and I think that if you learn to dock a ship with a very basic, then you can dock any ship. So
exactly. It's like when you first learn to drive a car, you learn with a manual transmission and no power steering.
Exactly.
Once you do that, you can do anything.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what are your challenges in the ports that you're going to?
Well, the ports, the challenges are mostly related to the weather, wind, and tight spots that we go to. So I think that's the biggest challenge, the changing of the weather, depending on the itinerary. So that's pretty much the only challenge that we go. Then there are day-to-day challenges, but I mean, day-to-day operation challenges. But I would say the weather's got the biggest impact in calling or not calling a port, for sure.
I mean, in so many ports, so you're required to have a tugboat, but you don't need it.
Correct. Yeah, in a lot of countries, it's compulsory to have it, so it's part of the port fees. But and I would say 9 times out of 10, we don't use it. But it's nice to have it in case you need it, for sure.
You know, when I've trained in a number of the simulators, and they all have joysticks these days, so I'm not used to that, right? But even when they don't have the joysticks, what people don't realize is you build up such momentum, even at slow speeds, that if you don't judge your distance, you're in trouble.
Yes, it's all about anticipating here compared to a boat or obviously a plane. It's all about doing things in advance and predict what's going to happen. That's a challenge. And as I was saying, changing weather forecast, that's what can have the impact.
Well, regardless of weather, what would you say in your cruising experience has been your most difficult port to navigate?
The difficult port, I would say, well, last February, as a matter of fact, we were in Fiji, and we were supposed to go alongside, but there was another ship there, and the pilot told me that there was enough space for us to find out that
there wasn't.
There was 2 meters of space. So we stopped about 3 meters from the other ship and 2 meters from the ship behind.
And you made it.
We made it because it was also turnaround port, so we had to make it.
Right.
And but yeah, the other ship that was supposed to
let's say the thrusters were working heavy.
The thrusters were working heavy, and the weather was good, but it was pretty tight. But you know, and sometimes that happens. You know, especially in some remote location, like in other countries where they're more organized, these things don't happen. But Fiji is pretty remote, I would say.
It's amazing when you think the explosion of the cruise industry, and yet so many different countries have not really upgraded their ports.
Yes, that is true, unfortunately. But I think it's changing, and in a lot of places, cruising is booming. So I think it's only a matter of time.
Oh, sure. Get ready for Cuba.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm sure that you guys are looking at that, too. Everybody wants to go to Cuba, right? They want to be first on their block.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a big rush to get to Cuba, add ports, because there are so many ships around now, and everybody's looking for different ports.
Well, they've actually charted about 8 viable harbors already.
Oh, I didn't even know that,
That doesn't mean they have docks.
No. But with Silver Sea, we go to really remote locations. So
you're used to it?
We're used to it, and we used to tender a lot as well, as we go to places where they don't have any infrastructure. So
today Venice, tomorrow Cuba.
Maybe.
Captain Alessandro Zanello from Australia. The captain of the Silver Spirit.
Thank you very much.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Let me go.
coming to you from a very special cruise ship on a very special cruise line. If you really want a more intimate experience and not mass tourism, I mean, I'll be kind. I got in trouble one day when I was on CBS, and I described some of these larger cruise ships as being so big, they've got high crime areas on board. And, of course, I was kidding, but they are small towns. This ship, less than 600 passengers, very intimate, and goes to ports that a lot of places, a lot of ships don't go, and different experiences. And normally, you know, you'd have, you know, you interview the captain on the ship, and that's the case here, of course. But we're lucky today because I get to interview the owner. He's the owner of Silver Sea, and he's a friend of mine, Manfredi Lefebvre. Hey, Manfredi, how are you?
Hello, Peter.
So, with that kind of an introduction,
not bad.
I'm glad you grade me on that. But on that kind of introduction, let's talk about how cruising has changed, because you've been in this business a long time. You know, when you think about the style of cruising, but most importantly, the expectations of the passengers, you have a very demanding set of passengers because this is in the luxury cruise area.
Oh yeah, my experience. I started in 1987, being involved in cruising. We built the first two new style cruise ships for a company called Sitmar at the time. So it's been a long way.
I remember Sitmar. In fact, I met a friend of mine who then went over to Princess, who was the public relations person for Sitmar, and Sitmar's no longer there. They're gone.
It got merged into Princess.
Yeah.
In any case, after that experience, we started Silver Sea 20 years ago, and it was the first company to introduce all-inclusiveness and almost all the cabins with balconies. And that was a big game changer at the time. But, you know, that's become the rule of the game in the luxury cruise segment. And things are changing, evolving always more.
But let's talk about the words all-inclusive, because one of my big pet peeves in the travel industry is when somebody says the words all-inclusive, it's usually followed by an asterisk. And that's usually telling you all the things that are not included, right?
Yes.
But when you came on board or you came online with this concept of a truly all-inclusive cruise, it really is that.
Yes. You on board the ship, you can basically do everything. If you want to have a massage at the spa, that's on top of it.
Right.
But food, drinks, breakfast, theater, everything is included.
And tipping?
No tipping.
Now, okay, let's talk about that, because it's one thing to say you have a no-tipping policy, but Americans, everything is different in different cultures, but in America, we're used to tipping, right? It's sort of something like where everybody is expecting to tip. On most cruises, you're even told what to tip. So by the time someone comes on your ship for the first time, there's sort of that expectation that they're going to have to. So it's sort of it's an adjustment, isn't it, for people to realize that they don't have to.
Absolutely. One thing is to tip because you're very satisfied of the service. You want to gratify somebody. Another thing is because that is part of his compensation. He's not paid by the restaurant or whatever. He's paid by you for the tip. At that point, he expects you. So I'll give you a little anecdote. When I was 18, I go to Boston. I have to pick up a girl and take her to a restaurant. I take a taxi. I arrive at the restaurant. The bill was $19.90. I had a $20 note. So I give him the $20 note, and I tried to evacuate the taxi as fast as I could. Not fast enough to have the taxi driver throwing at me a dime and saying, you need it more than I do. So that was my experience with U.S. tipping.
So you learned the hard way.
I learned the hard way.
But on this ship, what happens if a passenger wants to tip?
Yeah, well, of course, you can't prohibit somebody to give some, a sign of recognition to somebody. What is it? It is. It's not expected. People are not going to treat you differently. You don't have the list of the tips that you must give at the end of the cruise.
Yeah, I remember being given envelopes and a list of who gets what, whether it was the wine steward, your waiter, the housekeeper. I mean, it went down a whole list, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is, for a European, it's unusual to see that tipping is a way to compensate the people. In the U.S., if you give 15%, it's not enough.
Right. Now it's increasing. 20, of course. Absolutely.
It's increasing.
So all-inclusive here, with the exception maybe of a spa treatment, is really all
a spa treatment, if you want to have a special wine, some special Bordeaux wine. But, you know, the basic is all-inclusive, everything which is on the ship.
Now, in the development and the growth of a cruise line, and you can see this also in the airline business, you know, you reach a certain point of of diminishing returns in terms of size. You know, can you grow to be too big?
Yeah, the concept of too big is relative to times and what you get. So when we started Silver Sea, the two ships that we built were 300 passengers. Today, the ship we're building is 600 passengers. But there is an increase in size. But we are learning how to do it without losing the sense of intimacy and the community perception. And, of course, compensating some bigger size with more to do on board. So it evolves.
But you reach a point, sometimes at diminishing returns, where, I mean, I see it in the airline business where, you know, they try to grow too big, they try to go too fast, they build too much, they try to fly everywhere. How many ships do you have?
We're currently operating 8 and 9 under construction.
Okay, compared to, let's say...
104 Carnival Corporation.
Exactly.
They're very successful. I mean, it's so...
But it's a different different business model.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not only 104 ships, it's the number of passengers they carry, which is immense because they're big ships.
Right.
Now, I mean, there is a product for everybody. Some people enjoy to be on a very large community at sea. Some people hate it. And so, and then some people like to go to some shopping destination in the Caribbean, and some people like to go instead in some remote destination in the Russian Far East, like I was recently.
Right. Plus, you've got a ship in the Galapagos.
We have a ship in the Galapagos. We have ships in a lot of remote areas, which is on top of our classic luxury cruising.
Which is new for you because you're giving passengers choices other than the traditional ports.
Yeah, it's something more. No, so we. Really, today we go almost everywhere in the world.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.